Hello and welcome to At the Movies with Mike and Marie. I'm Marie Westaver.
And I'm Mike Giuliano.
And today we're going to talk about Japanese director Akira Kurosawa. He's had a long career of many different kinds of movies. He's mostly probably known best for his samurai films. But let's get into his origins, Mike, where he was coming from as a young Japanese man.
Well, in one sense, he's very Japanese. His family actually has samurai origins. And so he identifies in an almost aristocratic way with that. But simultaneously, he's oftentimes called the most Western of Japanese directors. And this is very much a generalization, and it doesn't entirely hold up, but I think it mostly does. Namely, that when you look at Japanese film studies, I've taught a course on Japanese film history at our college, and also presently I'm teaching an Asian film history course. So, I mean, it's an area that I teach. And when I teach it, we oftentimes set up a kind of juxtaposition or contrast. The most American, if you will, the most Western of Japanese directors would be Kurosawa. Why do we say that? Well, there's the mobile camera work, there's the faster editing. We're talking about the earlier films of Kurosawa, not the late career. But, you know, the way he shoots a film is what would be considered an American way to shoot a film. But as importantly, and I would argue even more so, is the fact that Kurosawa is attuned to Western culture. As a young man, he studied Western painting and literature. He was himself a gifted visual artist for sure. And when you watch his films, and also when you listen to them, not enough attention is paid to the soundtracks of Kurosawa's films. We talk visually as we have to, but listen to the musical scoring in so many of his films, you'll have Eastern instrumentation and also Western. You'll hear bits of Western classical music, bolero or something. You know, it gets worked right into it. And so Kurosawa himself was aware of this and had a kind of mixed response to, after all, it's a generalization and directors don't like to be boxed in quite that way, but Kurosawa was considered the most American, if you will, of Japanese directors. And Yasujiro Ozu, his somewhat older contemporary, was considered the most Eastern, if you will. The static camera, tatami mat shot, as they called it, the camera low and just hold on the players, and very traditional, very conservative, as opposed to Kurosawa. And Kurosawa was asked about this so often that he said himself that he was turning against the Ozu approach to subject matter and shooting. What he termed, this is Kurosawa's expression, what he termed, quote, the boiled rice and green tea austerity. Now think about that, you know, the boiled rice and green tea austerity of Yasujiro Ozu. He doesn't mean it as an insult. I mean, he actually admired him, but the fact that what could be more Japanese than to have your boiled rice and your green tea, but the austerity of it, the kind of like severe and spare and all that quality, that's what Ozu was known for. And he could respect that, but that wasn't how he wanted to go. Here's what Kurosawa wanted. And I love the food metaphors. I want to run out and get a meal right after taping this because, you know, that's what Ozu represents. But here's what Kurosawa is asking for. Quote, I want my films to be like a steak spread with butter and topped with good, rich, broiled eels. Now, I think I'll pass on the eels. But
you had me up till the ear, till the eel.
I'll go for the steak, actually. But you see what he's getting at there. He wants a richer, you know, and by that more diverse and more vigorous, more active, less of that a green tea austerity that you have with Ozu. And you see that contrast automatically. And so by the time Kurosawa enters the film industry in the mid-1930s, Ozu is still very much working. Ironically, Ozu is still making silent films into the 30s because Japan's a little late to get wired. And Ozu's subject matter, all those father-daughter stories, all those stories of, you know, conflict between tradition and modernity, that's established. And I don't know, I'm not saying that at all in a pejorative sense. I love Ozu's work. I love all those attributes that I've just been mentioning, but they're so at odds with the way Kurosawa will work. I mean, you can't imagine, you know, Ozu going out and making a vigorous samurai movie. But, you know, correspondingly, Kurosawa's not going to have people just sit down in his earlier films and drink tea and talk. You know, they're going to be moving a lot, right? So by the time Kurosawa starts making films, now I quickly will add that in Japan, as in a number of other countries, there's a longer period of apprenticeship than we typically have in Hollywood. So in countries like Italy, France, Japan, and so on, it's not unusual to be apprenticed to a major director or directors for a period of time. And that's certainly something that Kurosawa himself went through. But by 1943, he's making his own first film. And the kind of samurai films that we most associate him with, though I'll quickly add to that, that even though he's best known for the samurai movies, he's very versatile. He does a lot of contemporary subjects as well. We can talk about that as we go along.
You know, it's interesting, the business about him being a painter first, because that's also the way that Bergman and Fellini came through the painting door to make movies. Also, the fact that when he would make storyboards, he would actually make paintings, which seems so detailed. You know, I'm used to seeing storyboards that look more like sketches, little thumbnails, but he would, you know, envision it, you know, as stills that he would paint, which I think is a very interesting way to approach it.
And a lot of it, his artwork is still available. You can see examples of this. And, you know, very early, you're absolutely right. You look at those great directors like Fellini and so on, and you see them actually as visual artists. Hitchcock's another example. Why does Hitchcock do all that storyboarding? You know, early in his career, he's designing title cards, which are not just the words that you get inserted into a silent film, but also oftentimes artwork, either stylized typography or artwork around. He's thinking visually that way. And then Kurosawa, because he was such a skilled painter, I mean, you know, put aside whether it's Eastern or Western in orientation, just as a painter was so skilled that he would not just do a sketch, you're right, a traditional storyboard, he would paint more than he needed to. I'm trying to think how to say it. It's almost like, it's like enough already, I get the idea, right? But no, let me do the sky next. And he was like that. Now, very quickly to jump ahead and just quickly on this, late in his career, when he runs into trouble raising money for films and all kinds of problems, there are very sad stories about Kurosawa very late in his career, going from studio to studio, trying to convince producers to bankroll his films, and he would have his paintings, his storyboards under his arm. At this point, he's like, you know, in his 70s and 80s, and he's going door to door, basically, that way, trying to raise money. But he would say, look, here's how the picture's going to look, and he actually would produce the paintings. So throughout his career, that kind of planning meant a lot. And that's another area in which he's such a gifted director. And I'm not forcing comparisons with Hitchcock, but only to point out that when they went to shoot a film, that things had been storyboarded, they'd been worked out, every detail. And even in the earlier films, which are so fast moving and all, yeah, but they're fast moving with a purpose. It's not just arbitrary, let's move the camera. What's the camera gonna see? But then particularly in the late career, which becomes deliberately more static, it is like composing a painting. You know, this chair goes here, the actor stands there, and the actor gets moved around like a piece of furniture, doesn't he? And this is something Hitchcock was known for doing too. You know, you're dressing the set and you're thinking about composition as a visual artist would.
You know, interestingly, it appears that film is something that is in the family because he had an older brother, Heigo, who was a silent film narrator, who was out of work once things went over to the talkies. He also later took his own life, and there was a point in Kurosawa's career where he gave up and tried to commit suicide and didn't succeed.
Yeah, it's really, really haunting that the older brother really was a role model for Akira Kurosawa. And it went beyond like loving your brother, but it was that kind of older brother where the brother was in the film industry and he was what was known as a Benshi. They did more than provide narration. The Benshi actually would stand just off to the side of the screen. And as the silent film is being projected, they would give you the dialogue or a synopsis of the dialogue, but they also would kind of act it out a bit. You know, you're going to have it, like if you're going to give the lines that he said, she said, why not with your hands and otherwise just, you know, gesture. And so there was a bit of pantomime, if you will, also involved. So his older brother, it was a profession, just like, you know, if you played the organ, you know, in a movie palace, right? You know, that's your job, right? Your company silent films. That's what his brother did professionally. When sound came to Japanese films, and it came relatively late there, it was really more into the early 30s. But in any event, his brother essentially was out of work at that point. You know, there's no need for, you know, that occupation. I'm not saying it's the only reason, but it certainly was a very strong contributing reason as to why, sad to say, his older brother killed himself. Kurosawa himself, when you get into the late 60s and actually right 1970, 71, we can talk more about this in a while, was at a low point in his career financially and just in terms of not having the clout he once had with Japanese studios, where Kurosawa did attempt suicide, slashing himself with a knife multiple times. And so it's a really sensitive thing to talk about as to what extent was this entirely career related, you know, his older brother's despairing as sound comes to the silent cinema, or Kurosawa, Akira is despairing because, you know, he's having trouble getting movies made by the early 70s. And to what extent, you know, and it's very hazardous to say this, but, you know, is there any sort of genetic component? I mean, that's always the tricky thing. If you see a pattern of suicide within a family or suicide attempts within a family, to what extent is it just simply whatever life circumstances those people face? And to what extent is there some kind of genetic component even or predisposition? And that's a touchy thing to talk. It's almost like talking about alcoholism that way, right? To what extent, you know, does it run in a family? Well, at a genetic level, you know, how does that actually work? And so I'm not qualified to talk about that subject at all, And so I keep talking about it, but I'm just thinking, you know, and in the case of Kurosawa and his older brother, there's something there. There's some tendency towards depression, you know, which is warranted when your job's taken away or when you just can't raise money to make another movie. But you got to wonder a bit beyond that. And again, as you watch his movies, it's certainly an undercurrent sometimes. There are darker currents, if you will, oftentimes running through the cinema.
We should note, though, that in Japan, suicide is not quite as taboo as it is in other Western countries like here. It's in some ways considered a viable alternative.
Well, seppuku would be in the sense of, you know, a sense of honor and integrity. And if life's no longer worth living, there's a ritualized way to take you out of it. So you're right. It's not quite as ostracized as it would be in our culture. By the same token, you know, if you're a samurai warrior and you've lost in battle, you know, your sense of dignity, your sense of honor is there and it's at stake. And so if you take your own life, it can be actually admired. You did the honorable thing. The extent to which that carries over to the film industry, I'm smiling just because I'm saying, as you get into modern times, to what extent does that carry over? I think you're right, though, that kind of samurai spirit and a sense of integrity and that, you know, suicide would be considered an option there. But by the same token, when his brother killed himself, the other family members didn't exactly celebrate it and honor him for having killed himself. And with Kurosawa himself, you know, whether he actually meant to kill himself, you know, sometimes a suicide attempt is a cry for help. Kurosawa, when he, from what we know of it, when he cut himself, it was numerous times with a knife. But I think if he really had wanted to do it successfully, he would have, right? I think these were more the superficial cuts of what, like a cry of despair, right? That way. And again, this is armchair psychoanalysis, so I can't prove it at all. But my own feeling was it was just like an outcry, a sign of despair there, which is not quite the same. With ritualized suicide, as you know, there's a very precise way of doing it in terms of cutting the stomach. And Kurosawa, having made so many samurai movies and being himself of samurai descent, he knew how to do that. If he had wanted to kill himself in the honorable samurai fashion, he could have done it with a single drawing of the blade across his stomach. You know, he would have known how to do that. So I tend to read his suicide attempt a bit differently, but I don't know, it's such a grim thing to talk about. Let's talk about something else.
Yes, let's talk about the way that his Western sensibility may have made him more palatable to Western audiences. In particular, you know, he made some films that are sort of a Japanese take on Shakespeare. And most notably in Ron, he changes the three daughters of King Lear into three sons so that it would play better in Japan. But how do you feel about his Shakespeare remakes? Do we call them remakes, knockoffs, reboots? What would you say?
Well, you know what? He was really, really fascinated with Western literature, as I mentioned earlier. So he would have read Shakespeare. He would have read Dostoevsky. I mean, again, someone that he tapped into for subject matter. And he freely adapts those things. One of the great things about, first of all, let's backpedal a bit in terms of why he was so beloved in the West. It's important to remember nowadays, I mean, at the outset I held up, here's Yasujirō Ozu as the most Japanese of Japanese directors. Here's Akira Kurosawa, the most American of Japanese directors. That's how we tend to see it now. It's important to bear in mind that Ozu's films were virtually unseen in the United States into the 1960s. I mean, aside from like a really like core audience of, you know, cultists, people who would search out, you know, Japanese movies, but in terms of the American art house crowd, if you will, or college students or whatever, those films were not being shown in America to any great extent. And Japanese cinema itself was not well known in this country. The breakthrough film for both Kurosawa and for Japanese film in general was Rashomon, in 1950. It won the first prize at the Venice Film Festival. It received an honorary Academy Award as Best Foreign Film. And it meant a lot that the film itself had a story that people were fascinated by. What's the nature of truth philosophically? If something happens in the forest involving, you know, a samurai and a thief and this and that, you know, what actually happened, and telling the story from various vantage points, the so-called Rashomon effect. But the fact that the film was so influential in the United States, well, you know, it's one of his most famous films to this day, but it was the breakthrough there. And Kurosawa said that making that film and releasing it meant a lot in the ways I'm indicating, but meant a lot also for the Japanese people to bounce back from World War II, the devastation that extended to the movie studios, you know, of what happened in Japan. And, you know, cities were leveled, you know, just flattened, you know, including the movie studios in some cases. And to be able to bounce back in less than a decade, right? Just a few years later, even, to make films of that kind of international caliber and get recognition. Here's a quote from Kurosawa in terms of what that meant. For the Japanese people, who had lost the war as well as their pride, this meant immeasurable encouragement and hope. And so in Kurosawa's case, he was able to make, you know, the movies he wanted to make. And back to your question, a lot of them were looking to Western literature and influences there, and a kind of fusion of East meets West, if you will. Throne of Blood, 1957. It's his version of Macbeth, and yet there's not a single line of dialogue that comes from Shakespeare's play. Not a single word. Think of all the famous quotes in a film like that. Mm-hmm. There are figures that correspond. This is, you know, Macbeth, Lady Macbeth. You can kind of match up characters that way. The storyline's basically the same. The forest does move at the end in a similar fashion. You have things that really are very closely aligned to Shakespeare's play, but without any of the dialogue.
You would think he could have gotten in, is that a dagger I see before me?
Well, he takes the Western story, the Shakespeare play, and he gives you the essence of it. I mean, it absolutely is there. What does this play mean? You know, thematically, what elements do you conclude about Macbeth and his wife and so on? It's all there, but without any of the Elizabethan language, trying to find the Japanese equivalent, in other words. He doesn't even try there. He just keeps it as, so it's a kind of fusion of, and likewise, when I mentioned, don't just watch his films, listen to them. Listen to the music in Throne of Blood. It's a curious fusion of East and West in terms of the actual instruments, in terms of the orchestrations. It's really fascinating. And Rashomon is similar that way. So in his Shakespeare adaptations, likewise, by the time he makes Ran, you know, he's thinking about Shakespeare's King Lear, but he has no qualms about changing things rather than having, you know, three daughters, let's make it three sons, and, you know, because he knows fundamentally that the spiritual essence, the philosophical content is the same. He's making changes sometimes to adapt to what would be considered more Japanese motifs, to put it that way, but other times simply because it's his film. He hasn't signed a contract that he must be literally faithful to a Shakespeare play. It's the springboard for the film that he wants to make. And so he brings all those samurai elements to it that, you know, go far beyond what you would find in the Shakespeare play, but this is now his film.
Well, we should probably talk a little bit about Rashomon. I think that's the most famous of all of his movies, and it's probably one people have heard about and might seek out. And I wanted to mention that it opens with this fantastic shot of this gate that is falling down, and it's just being lashed with rain, and it's dark, and it's moody, and it's brooding, and it sets the scene for the movie. When you're watching it, though, take note of the rain itself, because Kurosawa was not happy with the way the rain was showing up on the camera, so he added some ink to the water so that it would show up on film. And if you actually look at the characters, you can kind of see the ink on their faces as the rain is hitting. And then it goes from there to this overly bright forest, as if you have stepped out of this dark area into the light. And he achieved a lot of that with use of mirrors and stuff in the forest, which today, of course, all of these techniques are pretty well established. People, you know, have done that since then. But at the time, it was very, very unusual and arresting and interesting. I'll also warn you that Toshiro Mifune's laugh in the movie will drive you insane. But it's worth watching to see him in this role because he went on to make so many movies with Kurosawa. He's such a huge Japanese actor that you have to see him in this trademark film.
Yeah, actually, Akira Kurosawa and Toshiro Mifune made 16 movies together. Most often samurai roles, but some contemporary roles. And it was one of the great partnerships of director and actor ever. I actually met Toshiro Mifune once in New York at a reception, and I was very polite, and I didn't want to get on his bad side. He really was a man of great strength and great dignity. You could just see it in his bearing. I mean, he had a kind of samurai build, and the face was set that way, that even though he was friendly, you realized that there was a great reserve of what I call strength or power. I mean, this goes beyond physical strength. This is a kind of confidence that an actor can have. And so when you watch the samurai roles in particular, when Mifune walks down a street, I mean, Yojimbo has a great example of this. It's sort of the Eastern Western, if you will, in terms of, you know, here's the powerful guy walking down the street. The crowds pull back, you know, and it's like, whoa, you know, he comes swaggering down the street. Again, it's in the body language as much as the language. In Rashomon, he does have that insane cackle of a laugh. He also has a dancer's energy. He's always bouncing around, moving around. So it's not just the physical strength I referred to before, the sheer physicality of him, but also the gracefulness he had. You know, he's built sort of like a wrestler or a boxer would be, right? But he doesn't have clunky, lumpy movement that way. He's actually very graceful with his movement. And you see it in Rashomon as he's dancing around the forest, basically. And you see it later in films like Yojimbo, Sanjuro, certainly the samurai films, where there's a kind of balletic quality almost. It's almost like a dance choreography, how gracefully he moves. And of course, that's one attribute of a samurai film, is that it's beautifully choreographed, isn't it? I mean, it's not just the murder and mayhem. It's just so gracefully shot that even when it's horrific action you're watching, at some level you admire it as you would watching a ballet, in terms of how the swords are being moved around and so on. And so anyway, even though he and Kurosawa had worked together since the late 1940s, because Rashomon was the breakthrough film for certainly American audiences, that's the first time, you know, 1950, early 50s, they would have become aware of Toshirô Mifune as the great star with Kurosawa.
You know, several Kurosawa's movies have been remade in America as Westerns. Seven Samurai from 1954 was remade as The Magnificent Seven in 1960. Yojimbo, which you've mentioned, from 1961, was remade as A Fistful of Dollars in 64. And we have to mention the fact that The Hidden Fortress of 1958 was a major inspiration for the Star Wars saga, which takes many inspirations from Westerns and is often referred to as a space Western. So it's interesting, if you've seen Star Wars, you actually already know something about Kurosawa, even if you didn't know it.
In fact, I remember once years ago, I went to hear George Lucas speak in Washington, and during the Q&A, he was asked about Hidden Fortress, and he acknowledged, and it was fascinating because he went on at some length, how he loved that Kurosawa film in particular, and that, you know, the figure of Princess Leia has a corresponding princess, if you will, in the Japanese film, and how much he was getting from Kurosawa. And in fact, late in life, when Kurosawa had trouble raising money to make his films, some of the help that he did get at that point came from George Lucas and Francis Ford Coppola and Steven Spielberg in terms of financing, partially financing some of the later films, helping with marketing and distribution. And also they were really significant in getting Kurosawa an honorary Academy Award for lifetime achievement. So this is a kind of East meets West phenomenon. Earlier we mentioned how Kurosawa is drawing on a lot of Western culture for his films. And just, you know, a few minutes ago, as we talked about Shakespeare in particular, but it's flowing both ways. So you have Kurosawa making samurai films that are influenced by John Ford Westerns. Mm-hmm. And then you have Americans, young Americans at that point, like, you know, Lucas and Spielberg and so on. They're watching films like this. And then, you know, they'll turn around and make a film that in some ways is borrowing from Kurosawa. So these cross-cultural currents are going across the Pacific. And you see it happening, certainly, you're right, by the late 50s, early 60s. That there's a measure of influence, isn't it? That Hollywood would, you know, make a Western that's directly based on a Kurosawa film. This goes back, you know, we're going back like 60 years at this point, right? What a long period of time Hollywood's been taking from Kurosawa as he was taking from it. And I love that, actually, that if film truly is, as it obviously is, an international medium, that it just keeps flowing. The influences don't just go one way. They go back and forth.
It's actually a great homage because he was a huge fan of John Ford, who was his primary influence as a filmmaker. And when they met, Ford was nice to Kurosawa. And afterwards, Kurosawa started dressing similarly to Ford when he was on film sets. When he actually met him in the 60s, Ford said to him, "You really like rain." To which a delighted Kurosawa replied, "You've really watched my films."
In terms of the wardrobe, in 1980, I was covering the New York Film Festival, and Kurosawa was there with Kagamusha, one of his samurai epics. And, you know, I was there for the press conference with Kurosawa, and the reason I mention in particular is I looked at how he was dressed. He was dressed like he was John Ford on the film set. You know, he really had a similar outfit to what you would expect, even extending even to the cap, you know, that you would expect to see on John Ford. And I don't think he was doing it like to be, you know,
cosplaying.
No, I mean, I don't think he was really like consciously like trying to make that impression, but simply by that point in his life, he was not only wearing Western style clothing for the most part, as he always had actually, but the fact that as a film director, he was dressed like what he thought a film director should dress like, right? And because he so admired John Ford, I'm looking at Kurosawa on stage and I thought, you know, he had this sort of bulky build and a shirt and pants and a cap that looked just like what I've seen on John Ford when John Ford's on a film set. So it's really remarkable. And in terms of the influence of Kurosawa, film critics tend to be, you know, snide, cynical people and so on. But when we were in the same room with Akira Kurosawa, It was like an audience with God. I mean, it was just like, you know, almost worshipful that, you know, my God, this is one of the world's greatest filmmakers. And, you know, at that point in his career, Kurosawa frankly kind of needed the boost because he'd had a kind of bumpy career in the 70s and then, you know, had a late career resurgence with Kagamusha and then with Ran. But that shows you, even the world's greatest directors, you can have all that reputation, but at a certain point in your career, for various reasons we can talk about, if you have trouble raising money, you have trouble raising money, you know, and it doesn't matter that you have an Academy Award and the film books I'll write about shows, you know, in the Pantheon, one of the great directors ever. Well, knock on some producers' doors and they're not going to answer.
You know, he also took to wearing sunglasses all the time, even indoors or at night, because he said he spent so much time in the editing room that his eyes were hypersensitive to even ordinary daylight or lamplight, which brings us to his later career, Mike. And briefly, what would you like to say about his movie Dreams?
Well, in terms of the later career, everything we've said about the early career, mobile camera work, fast editing, kind of swift pace, very American style filmmaking to generalize, there's an evolution in the career. That's the early career. The later career, quite deliberately and kind of ironically, sees him making films that are shot more like Ozu would shoot a scene. He's thinking, as we mentioned earlier, you know, as a painter would think, composition. And the camera deliberately becomes more static. Sometimes he'll place the camera where he wants it, and all of mise-en-scène, everything framed within the scene has been so carefully worked out, actors will like enter and exit the frame, if you will, right? He'll hold the shot, and there's a kind of deliberate pacing, which is almost completely at odds with a film like Rashomon. So by the time you get to Kagamusha and then Ran, there's a stately quality to them. Sometimes maybe a little too slow, too deliberate, but the fact that as a director, he's you know, reached that point, this is how he wants to work now. In the late career, a partial exception to that, I would say, is Dreams, which actually teaching Asian film history, it's a film I use in coursework, actually using it this present semester even. And it's a film I like a lot. But the thing about Dreams is it's unusual within his body of work because it's episodic. I mean, so much so that it's a series of vignettes that thematically are linked in terms of man and nature and so on, but otherwise are distinct stories. And within them, he really varies things in terms of how he shoots a sequence. Some of those late sequences are very much that late style with the fixed camera and things worked out in a painterly way. Some of the others, not quite so much. I mean, it depends on subject matter and landscape and all that. But it's really a fascinating film because I think it's where you see Kurosawa arguably at his most painterly. You have, in fact, one of the episodes deals directly with Vincent Van Gogh, who's played, believe it or not, by Martin Scorsese. And here you have one of his great admirers, right? But, you know, here you have a Dutch artist working in France, but who has a New York accent. It's the funniest thing. And I don't say that like in a way to make fun of it. Somehow it works, but, you know, like logically it shouldn't. But the fact that, you know, you have him dealing directly with Van Gogh, and also in terms of how he shoots the film, a lot of it's naturalistic, out in nature, here's how it looks and so on, but a lot of it is painterly. And in fact, indeed, George Lucas's Industrial Light and Magic contributed to some of the special effects there. So it's a combination of natural photography and special effects enhancement. And the color palette is that of a very expressive artist. Some of the colors are not exactly what you would see in nature. So if there's a little bit of red in an actual landscape, there'll be as much red as in the theater seats behind you there in the film that he's shooting. And so again, he's thinking expressively there. And so in the same way Van Gogh, I mean, does a landscape, and you could say, well, was that blue really out there? Was that yellow? No, this is the artist's imagination, what he does. So very sympathetically, Kurosawa was doing something similar. So I like some of the episodes more than others, but I think Dreams is a really fascinating late career film. In director's careers, like what should you go out? It's not his final film, it's one of his final films, but what note should you go out on? And I think it's a perfect way for a director who's well into his 80s at that point to make a film that kind of sums up so many of his themes throughout the career. And that's why it's episodic. You know, here's an episode dealing with this, an episode with that, all linked in various ways, but still, you know, stories he wants to tell. And they're all based directly, Kurosawa said, on dreams he had. He has a dream, now he'll make an episode based on that dream.
Coming up at the end of October, we will be discussing Kurosawa's 1952 film, Ikiru, in our new Friday Film Fans discussion. And if you would like to participate in that, go to howardcc.edu/ film festivals for all the information about that discussion and the other ones for this season. Also, be sure to check out our other episodes of At the Movies with Mike and Marie on dragondigitalradio.podbean.com. And we will see you later at the movies.
See you then.
Connect with us. We are Dragon Digital Radio.